You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Craig Foster is one of the world's leading natural history filmmakers and co-founder of the Sea Change Project. He won an Academy Award for Best Documentary for his film My Octopus Teacher and has created more than 100 films and documentaries in addition to his photography. His new book is Amphibious Soul, Finding the Tame in a Wild World. Thank you for joining me, Craig.
Wonderful to be here, Rick. Thanks so much.
This book is really a masterful understanding of narrative. We can read it as a straight-up autobiography, and it's absolutely compelling reading because of the unusual and wonderful life you've lived. We can read it as a look at how you became a filmmaker and how filmmaking narratives played an important part in your life. And most importantly, this book presents to us an understanding and a theory of wildness. I'd like you to just describe to me what you mean by wildness.
Yeah, that's the fundamental question. Thanks, Rick. So for me, wildness is the connection to nature. It's the connection to our deep past. It's the connection to millions of years of living in wild spaces, in small groups. And it's about identifying with that enormous legacy and inheritance that we come with from, you know, the earliest hominins who invented fire to the first people who created art and science on the coast here in South Africa 100,000 years ago. It's about the genius of wild people and how they survived and how they lived in tremendous reciprocity with nature. So it's very, wildness can sometimes people think of it in a primitive sense, but it's very, very sophisticated. And the lives of the wild people that I've studied for many years are, in my mind, far more sophisticated and multidimensional compared to our lives today.
You talked about where you are now. You were brought up in the tip of Africa. This is the cradle of humanity, as you describe it. I'd like you to talk about how being brought up, you know, spending your youth in these wild places helped you find a different vision for the world than is common in today's human civilization.
I was very fortunate enough, Rick, to grow up in a tiny wooden bungalow that was actually below the high water mark. And when the big Atlantic storms came in, the sea used to rush around our house and throw up rocks and throw up pieces of kelp. And we had a whole protocol for protecting the house from the storms. So we had to put these wooden boards up to stop the windows breaking. And when we came out in the morning after a big storm, the front lawn was often a meter or two deep in kelp that had been brought up. We had, you know, animals from the ocean moving through the house, often the isopods that come up from the intertidal during the storms would come through the house. So it was this magical childhood. And I started diving, you know, when I was 3 years old in the kelp forest and foraging in the intertidal from even a younger age. So I was very fortunate enough to grow up in this wild crucible that stayed with me for the rest of my life.
I think your parents were really instrumental in helping you achieve a sense, or I guess the way you were brought up enabled you to come to an understanding of wildness. I'd like to just talk about the important part that your parents played in this process of you becoming at once a modern human being, making films and traveling around the world and immersing yourself in science, but also becoming, remaining, or discovering a primitive human being within that, or what we might call primitive. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean that in that you are more connected to our history and our world.
Yeah, so my father taught me to dive at a very young age. In fact, when I was brought home from the nursing home on my first day of life, he took me home and put me straight into the Atlantic Ocean, 12 degrees water. So it was initiation from the first day. My mother, when I was in the womb, dived almost every day in the kelp forest while she was pregnant. So they prepared me very well. My grandparents, my great-gran and my gran, used to come every day, and we used to, my brother and myself, used to relate the stories of our adventures on the shore and in the ocean to them. So they played a big part in the storytelling of that wild environment. And of course, this place has this incredible prehistory. I work and have worked for many years with an incredible group of paleo archaeologists who've studied the Middle Stone Age people who lived in this area I live in, and have discovered the oldest art and oldest science on Earth. So you're living in this incredible place that inspires the wild person, I believe, in that's inside all of us to actually emerge. You know, so much of our life today, unfortunately, that wild person is smothered by the tame environment we find ourselves in.
You know, one of the things that really appealed to me about this book was your sense both of storytelling in the book, but also the import that storytelling played in your life. Could you talk about how your upbringing, and you just discussed this briefly, of you are immersed not just in the natural world, but also in stories of the natural world, which is the most human way to relate to things.
Yeah, I'm very drawn to storytelling. And I guess, I've been diving specifically now my whole life, but I've been diving intensely for the last 12 years, pretty much every day. So that's 4,400 dives. And my best teachers, my best storytelling teachers, Rick, are the animals that I'm close to every day. So these animals show me their lives and these incredible stories that are there in the kelp forest. And it's sometimes, you know, it's not like human storytelling where you get it all nicely laid out. I get tiny pieces of the story from day to day, from month to month. Sometimes takes me 6 or 7 years to work out one story. But you can imagine the power of that when all those dots come together and you think, oh my goodness, this is the story of this incredible cuttlefish or shark or stingray or otter. And oh my goodness, this is the story. And it can take years and years to unfold, but it's more powerful because of that.
That is a fascinating insight. And, you know, as I read this book, one thing I found about your storytelling that was so interesting would be that you would start describing something, say, like tracking and as a means of storytelling. And I would immediately, you know, after reading a couple pages, twig to it. And I think, wow, this is a really fun thing to come out of my reading. And then, like maybe 5 pages later, you'd externalize it and say, tracking is a form of storytelling. And you do this happened to me probably 7, 8, 9, 10 times while reading this book. I think that is a really interesting means of storytelling to let your reader discover something and then say, this is what I have discovered, and it's really a powerful reading experience.
It's fascinating that you say it like that. I mean, I don't know how much of it is conscious or how much of it is just the natural storytelling. And I must just acknowledge also, I mean, the amazing editors and people I've worked with, the team at my agency, Idea Architects, Sarah and Rachel. I mean, they're just incredible. So it's and the team at HarperCollins, I've been very fortunate, Rick, to work with these incredible minds as well. My wife, Swati, also helps me tremendously. So it's quite a hive mind, often working on these things. And then we add all the minds of these incredible animals into the mix. So I feel it's a sort of a collective project as well. And these people and these animals have just been, so I feel so kind and generous in this process. So I think when you read, it's quite a lot of that collective mind coming through. Yeah, I mean, storytelling is at the heart of the human culture. I mean, from the deepest time, that's what we did. We went out into the landscape, onto the coast, and we came back and we told the stories. That's fundamental to our nature.
You know, that's such a powerful thing. I love the idea of your discovery of stories over a length of years. That's a really fascinating thing, and I think to a certain extent that also ties in with your process of shaping stories with a small group of people, because that's what you did as a filmmaker.
Exactly.
It was really necessary. So I'd like you to talk about bringing, and this is one of the most joyous parts of this book, is all the human relationships that it turns around with your photographers, with your wife, with your parents, with the people you work with, the people you dive with. But talk about the import of human community in your book and also in returning to our native wildness.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, there's often this vision of the sort of lone ranger in nature connecting to wildness. And for me, that doesn't, I mean, I've had amazing times alone, and I do dive alone quite often, but one has to remember we are intrinsically a social species. We are designed to live in a group of 20 to 30 people. We're designed to be nomadic, and we're designed to live in environments where there are which just enormous numbers of animals and plants. That's what every wild born child, even today, is expecting. And of course, it's very different when they come out and see what we've created. So what is very powerful is developing a group of people who also enjoy diving, enjoy swimming, and enjoy tracking. And to experience that with them is probably, you know, one of the greatest things that one can do, the shared love and fascination for wild nature. That is something that is a primal activity. It's something that brings great joy. And I'm very fortunate to have these amazing groups of people. And we go out every week and do this. It's part of our work, but it's really our deepest passion. And it's when a whole lot of minds, when we're tracking underwater, we're tracking on land, and we've got all these eyes and minds and ears and noses taking in these wild messages. Rick, we're speaking the oldest language on earth. That's what this is. This is a language that has been known from the very beginning. And even when I say it now, the hairs stand up on the back of my neck, because there's something very real about that. And it takes us to the beginning, and it's this language of reciprocity with Mother Earth.
One of your major teachers were the San. Explain to us who they were and how they taught you, because I think their teaching, it was more like, I think you had a relationship with the sand, and by virtue of having a relationship with the sand, they had a relationship with the world, and they were able to share that with you. And the upshot of that was that you became more a part of this world than you were before.
They had a massive influence on me, Rick. And, you know, when we first went up there, was many, many years ago. I think it was now 30 years ago. And I can still remember it so clearly, meeting these master trackers in the Kalahari. And at first being absolutely mind blown by their abilities and their extreme understanding of wild animals and tracking. And then having this very strange and unnerving and disturbing feeling that I was nowhere near their ability and their understanding. It almost felt like I was sitting outside of nature and my wild person was smothered. And I so desperately wanted to be inside of nature. And they motivated me actually to think, okay, how am I going to do this? And the only way of doing it and understanding this old language is just by going into the wild every single day and just trying to open one's mind and taking down notes and trying to understand. And at first, it feels absolutely impossible and overwhelming. But if you just keep at it, after a few years, you start to feel that old language coming back and you can put little sentences and ideas together. And eventually, it took me more than 7-8 years to be able to at least speak some of that language again. And I felt quite transformed and quite different.
You know, one of the things you describe in the book is that somebody had put a tracker on a kind of a deer, like a camera, and it's running around and you see things from the way the deer sees. And when you showed that to one of the sand, he said, "That's how I see things when I am in contact with that animal." It's such a powerful moment. Talk about that kind of immersion in nature till you want, by virtue of understanding you are part of nature, you really actually become a part of nature.
So that's a fascinating thing you've picked up there, Rick. Amazing detail. What we were trying to do, and this was an incredible tracker, a man named Karua Langwani. He was a core master tracker in the central Kalahari. And he had this ability to actually put his mind into the mind of the animal. And it was hard to initially believe, but he would actually leave the physical tracks and not follow them and be able to go straight to the animal was again and again. So we were asking him, how is this even possible? And it was hard to understand. But then we were fascinated by what actually is he visualizing and is he seeing. So what we did was we had a tiny camera and we actually put it on our family dog. And we put it all over the dog, all the different angles. We eventually would get that camera onto a semi-tame springbok. But when we showed him all the camera angles, he was saying, no, 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 no. But the angle, when we had this little harness underneath the dog's body, when you could see all four legs and paws striking the ground, that's what he said. That's exactly what I see. So he was almost inside the animal's body and seeing how the hooves or the paws were striking the ground. So this incredible ability to visualize how that animal was moving, what it was thinking, and where it was going.
One of the things that fascinates me is your ability to change the form, I guess, of your wildness between the sands of the Kalahari Desert and the depths of the kelp forest. You have a really interesting experience in the kelp forest, in that, you know, you have to immerse yourself in water, and that, you know, death is ever at hand. Could you talk about just the feeling of immersion in water, really? Does that help you achieve the distance you need from civilization that you need to experience the feeling of wildness, your primitive hominid self?
It definitely helps me tremendously. And I think it's obviously because I've grown up from a very young age doing that. But what also happens, it's what I've chosen to dive winter and summer without a wetsuit. And what happens, Rick, is the cold transforms one's brain chemistry. So you feel quite altered after spending even 5 minutes in cold water. And the colder it is, the more the brain chemistry changes. And it kind of opens up your whole consciousness. So that helps tremendously to focus on the tracking, on the animals, on the environment. And it kind of takes you into this other world. So the world of technology and computers and cars seems to vanish completely. And you're in this completely wild, cold, beautiful, three-dimensional underwater forest. And over time, you get to know the animals in that forest. They feel like kin. They feel like family. So it's almost like you're in this absolutely fantastical world, but you start to know it very well and trust it. And it's like a second home. So you're going into this place of extreme wildness again and again and again. And that allows that wild person, that timid wild person inside, to actually start coming out a bit. And that's a fantastic feeling.
You did speak quite a bit about the virtues of cold immersion. And also, I think they're linked inextricably with your feelings of understanding and embracing fear. And again, I don't mean fear in a pejorative sense. I mean in an exploratory sense. Fear is really a necessary emotion to get out in the world in places where you might never otherwise go.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. When you say that, I mean, in the early days, I was quite afraid of sharks, probably from watching Jaws when I was young. And then I was fortunate enough to work on this film and other projects that were connected to sharks. And I eventually got to free dive very close to five large adult great white sharks. And, you know, these animals were just so beautiful. They couldn't have been more different from the monsters from the Jaws film and other films. They were very relaxed. I didn't feel in any way threatened by them. But the most interesting thing was not only their beauty, but when I got out of the water, that experience fundamentally changed my part of my brain that registered fear, so much so that when I got into my car, it was extremely hard to put the seatbelt on, which I'd always worn, because I didn't feel any fear of dying. It had altered that. Of course, that slowly seeps back, but it's facing these things that you think are so fearful, but that are wild and fresh and powerful, gives you resilience to the, you know, much more real fears that I think we face in our world today. So it was fascinating to see how this experience in the wild diminishes one's fear and kind of opens one up to other possibilities for consciousness.
In a sense, this book reminded me a bit of some of the old Carlos Castaneda books in finding the opportunities for other styles of consciousness within the modern world. And I think that that's something we really need now. Could you talk about just the way in which you have decided, you know, you have shaped your own consciousness consciously. And I think that that's a fascinating choice. And I think in part that that comes from the stories you experience and the stories you tell.
I mean, I think that I'm, I certainly draw from a lot from nature and from animals, but I'm also quite sensitive. So I sometimes get thrown by things, and I'm definitely not impervious at all to the difficulties of life. And I've, you know, sometimes struggled with things, but I've found that if I can return regularly every day and remind myself how my fundamental nature is put together and that I am part of this wild environment, even though I sometimes don't always feel that, that has a wonderfully positive effect on our mental health. And what's very interesting is, now around the world now, some doctors are actually prescribing time in nature, like literally writing out a script, because we're starting to understand that human beings desperately need that. It's part of our absolute fundamental. We are, some people are obviously very tough, but many, many people feel this tremendous difficulty being separated from the mother. We have lived for millions of years completely interwoven into the matrix of wild nature. And now that disconnection we feel as a deep conscious or unconscious trauma. And when you start reconnecting and spending time, and especially spending time doing the things I talk about in the book, like tracking, like cold water immersion, like studying animal behavior, that builds back those threads that have been broken. And then the consciousness, it's much easier to function and live and feel excited about life.
One of the ways I think that you achieve this is through the use of ritual. I'd like you to talk about, you know, the rituals you engage in. And I think that ritual acquires more power over time, and that's one of the things I like about what you said today and what I read in your book, is that you are a very patient man.
My wife might not agree with you, but I'm quite patient, I guess, with nature. I think the ritual is very important, and rituals being part of our human species, you know, for a very, very long time. And I've been very fortunate to have joined the San in one of the oldest rituals on this planet, the trance dance. But I have, yeah, very simple rituals. I do, you know, breath training every morning. I try to go every day into the ocean itself. And I have a kind of dialogue, a simple dialogue with the wild intelligence. I find that if you have that sort of daily ritual of connection to the wild, sometimes I will even, you know, because of I've been fortunate enough to work with so many indigenous people, I'd sometimes use substances like the red ochre, which is a substance used by early people for a very, very long period of time. Hundreds of thousands of years. And I'll sometimes just use some of that substance to remind me of how important nature was to early people and how important it is to us today. So just generally very simple reminders of our wild nature and our gratitude for all these creatures that make life possible. Without biodiversity, without the life support system of this planet, you and I and everybody else would not be able to breathe or eat or function in any way. It's the fundamental of everything we do. Yet in our, you know, very fast-moving, tame world, we've forgotten that. And that's what I think is so critical to bring back, this, that we are utterly reliant, like a small, fragile child, we're utterly reliant on biodiversity and Mother Nature to keep us alive.
You know, I love the way that you discuss the animals you meet in this book. And it's a vast variety, everything from flies to, you know, the giant crocodiles, ancient dragons, you call them. You approach them not as fundamentally different from you, not as, when most people say animal, they draw a hard line between the animal and the human. You do not. You approach them on their level and take what they do as seriously as you might take it if, you know, a fellow photographer came up to you and said, here's this great camera, it does this and this, and this is how you can get better color. It's the same, you have the same approach to that human as you might, as you do to a fish that you encounter several times. There was one fish, a mollusk sucker or something.
Rock sucker.
Yeah, I love the names of all these, of the animals. They're really colorful and delightful to read. But, I mean, you approach that, it's like, you know, a fellow you might see on the beach every day. You see, after a while, you might say hi, and then you might say, oh, nice day out, eh?
I mean, absolutely. If you think about it, even scientifically, we, all animals, and us, we are a human animal as well, are products of 13.7 billion years of creativity of this universe. I mean, this is, I was fortunate enough to work with an amazing cosmologist, Brian Swim, who studied this his whole life. So I've got some sense through him of that we are literally put together from this galactic dust, and that by some mysterious way formed into all these creatures. So we're made of the same substance, we're made of the same molecules. I think that consciousness is flowing like a big giant river through all of us. We're obviously expressing it in very different ways, and it's very hard to get into the minds of some of these animals, truly get into their minds. You can get into their behaviors, and through the tracking, one can understand their behaviors in quite detail. But they really are our family, and we've come through evolution. They are our ancestors. They literally, you know, we made up of them. Our minds, our instincts are built from them. There's this tremendous unity, this oneness between us and all of creation. And the more one immerses in the secret lives of these animals, and the more they teach me, certainly, the more I can feel that tremendous unity. And this idea that we're really not separate from them and their lives. It's all interwoven. And that's the real teaching that I've got from these animals. I'm just really passing on, you know, what they know and what they've told me in this sort of, you know, best way I can, which sometimes is difficult, but I try.
You know, as a storyteller, in this book, you do a wonderful job telling your stories in words. You're also a filmmaker, which is a very different form of storytelling. You can, in a 2-second film, you can capture, in a sense, what would take maybe 20 pages to write out, but also in 2 pages of writing, you can express inner thoughts that film or art, other forms of art, can't capture. I'd like you to tell us why you chose filmmaking as a form of storytelling. It's a pretty technological form at this point, although it's been made in incredibly powerful, as your film would tell us.
So I'm very drawn to filmmaking because, of course, you can use visual and sound together, and voice and text, and so many aspects. So you can bring the emotion of something through very, very powerfully. It's harder to do that with words alone. So what I've done, and I couldn't help myself with this book, and as you say, the writing is quite a different form of storytelling. While I was writing this book, I couldn't help myself. I made a whole lot of short films directly related to the stories in the book. And I managed to persuade our wonderful publisher, Harper, to put a digital code in the middle of the book. So you can click on that code and it takes you to this beautifully designed space where you can actually watch these 27 short films that relate to the stories in the book. So it's like a multi-sensory experience. And I'm very interested to see how people relate to this, both reading and to be able to see the films. And these are films that are just pure passion films, short films I've made. Some of them are quite raw. They haven't gone through this huge process of being edited by the broadcasters. So it's been a very interesting and powerful process. So I love film. It's my greatest love. But sometimes it's very arduous. The making of films is very arduous, and the delivering to the broadcasters is a very difficult process. So I love this writing the book. It's very freeing, and the teams we work with are so wonderful. So I've somehow managed to, I think, put the two together, and I'm interested to see the reaction.
Well, I will tell you that my experience was, I think, like that of some of the earliest readers of books, when monks would create what were called illuminated manuscripts, where they used not illustrations, so to speak, of what was done, but to enhance the letters and the message directly, so that the idea, I think, was that the beauty of the manuscript would bring you closer to the beauty of God. And in a similar way, your films that are in this book, which are just stunningly beautiful, bring you closer to the feel of what the book is getting at, which is, in a sense, I guess, the ineffable power of wildness. And I love, and I thought that this was the case, it was great to hear you confirm it, that these films themselves were not massaged, but were what, you know, essentially, you know, illuminations from your heart about the experiences you had writing this book. So one of the things, too, that struck me was that in your film, you combined the filmmaking, the power of the visual images, with your narration. And that's two different storytelling styles kind of merging into one. I'd like you to talk about that kind of process of experiencing a story essentially twice, first visually and then in adding the wonderfully sparse but powerful narration that you did for your work.
Yeah, so I mean, in the short film series for the book, I've mostly just narrated it, written the script and narrated it quite simply. The process for My Octopus Teacher, which, you know, this is happened quite a long time ago now. We made that film quite a long time ago. That was, the narration there was a series of interviews done by the directors over 4 days, grueling hours and hours and hours every day. And then the even more grueling process of editing that, those questions and those answers and just those, that talking into that, you know, 80-minute piece that makes up the narrative. But I guess the advantage of doing it like that is you don't get a chance to think exactly how you're going to say everything. You just say it straight from the heart, and then they edit it into something that makes sense. So it's a powerful, but it's a long way of doing it. So that's really how that worked. I hope that answers the question.
You know, one of the things I really liked about the short films was the whole rawness of the experience. Today, so much of our art is so heavily mediated. You know, music is just processed to death and it's auto-corrected, and it loses, I think, a lot. That's why people like to see a live band. Could you talk about you know, and making sure that your work has that direct feeling of rawness, because that's also in the book too. It really feels like, you know, these are outpouring from your heart, and that matters a lot.
I think that the difference here, Rick, and I'm so glad you felt that, is that this is not something that's scripted. This is not something that is planned. This is going out into the wild environment like I do every day while I'm writing the book, and I'll see something and I'll photograph it and I'll rush back home and I'll just start editing and I'll put it together. And the feelings and the stories and the ideas will just come. It's purely driven by passion and fascination for the wild. And then I'm very fortunate. My son Tom, he's only in his early 20s, but he's passionate about soundtrack, sound design, and music composition. And he's done a lot of that in his young life. And then he would take the piece and work it. And it's just absolutely magnificent working with your son, you know, and he understands me so well. I've taught him to dive from a very, very young age as well. He knows this environment well. He loves it. So it's just this pure piece of passion for the nature that comes, you know, comes out. And hopefully that some of that comes through. And it's not done over too many times or re-edited too many times. It's just put out there, that raw sense of wildness.
You know, one thing you brought up, spoke a word a while back, and I think that's very important to this idea of wildness, which is gratitude. I think that gratitude is not just a means of giving thanks, but really a way of understanding what is important and why.
It's absolutely critical, Rick. I mean, you know, and I've learned this a lot from Indigenous people. If you think about this, I mean, amazing fact that 80% of the biodiversity in this world is protected by Indigenous people. And they have such gratitude for nature. And I think the other big word that goes with that gratitude is reciprocity. So we're not just having this idea of, oh, there's these wonderful nature, all these resources, let's just extract them. It has to be, this is what we fundamentally need to change in our consciousness, is how can we give back to our mother that's given so much to us? How can we regenerate? How can we nurture her on a daily basis? Because we love her so much, but also in the backs of our minds, it's a she's looking after us. We're utterly reliant on her. So I think those two senses of gratitude and reciprocity are absolutely fundamental to our future survival.
Reciprocity is such an important word, and one of the things I think that I really like about your book is that as I read it, I feel that you are aware of the reader and trying to give to the reader, and also want to expect the reader to give something back to you in terms of an increased ability to perceive the world around them. And that's one of the upshots of reading this book, is you close this book and the world around you is no longer the same. And I'm wondering, you know, talk about using storytelling to change consciousness of readers.
Oh, that's a powerful question and a powerful observation on your part. I mean, my greatest gift would be if I can, through the book, have people thinking and finding ways to reciprocate to nature and to look for ways to regenerate biodiversity. That would be the ultimate thing. And I think, you know, storytelling, all our actions, everything we do is based on a story in our heads. You know, if we think it's okay to go and, you know, mine the deep ocean, and then we've told ourselves a good story around that, that's what we'll do. If we have a story in our head that if we do that, we're actually going to be endangering our life on this planet, and we're going to be, you know, ruining the lives of so many incredible animals, that story will stop us doing that. The stories are the things that drive our emotions and our dreams and our actions. So that if we can fundamentally transform our story and move towards more of this reciprocity and gratitude that we've talked about, that is a massively powerful thing we can do. So story is actually driving everything. We've forgotten that in many ways. It's the fundamental of all we do before anything. And our beliefs and our stories are the things that manifest in this world for good or for bad.
One thing it's clear to me in reading this book is the import and your love for your family, from your parents, your brother, your grand, your son, whom you, interestingly, you said you were immersed in the water of the ocean the first day of your life, and you made sure your son had the same experience, and your wife, who you just tell a fascinating story about her and her relationship with a tiger. Talk about the import of family and understanding the family relationships in terms of understanding our own wildness, in that family is the most natural relationship in the wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's so well put, Eric. I don't think I could do any better than what you've described. But I mean, I was actually just only thinking, you know, I get up very early in the morning and just thinking how powerful love is. And then there's this feeling, my wife is a just extraordinary person who's grown up in a very loving family, and it just comes so naturally to her. And, you know, sometimes it's quite difficult to give to others emotionally or whatever. And sometimes you think you're going to lose something. But of course, I was just thinking this morning, if you give with love and then you just get, you know, so much back, why would you ever not do that? But of course, you need the cycle and circle of reciprocity. And I'm just very fortunate to be married to someone who is tremendously loving. And my family have been very supportive and loving in so many ways. And then it's, of course, easy for that circle to just grow. But it's, I mean, I think that if we look at our species, and I look, and especially at the Middle Stone Age, when, you know, our consciousness really changed in a fundamental way, in a similar way to what it is today, we see the first art and science. There's almost no violence at that time. There's you can see in the archaeology, you can see in the numbers of people, you can see in a lot of ways through the window of science and archaeology that we have this very possible non-violent origin We are an empathic, loving species by nature. We've been tremendously pressurized to be doing some pretty terrible things, but it's the pressure. At the heart of it, we've got this immense love for other people, but also for other creatures and plants. So I think there's a lot of hope that, you know, this can come back strongly. We just need to give ourselves a bit of a chance and take less pressure off our lives.
You know, you speak often today, you spoke often today and in your book about deep time, you know, millions of years, humanity's reaching back and the way we were shaped over millions of years. And we now have an eye blink, essentially, of civilization on top of that. And I think even in the way you speak, which is with a kind of a deliberate, thoughtful pace, you approach life slowly. And I'd like you to talk about, you know, the import of the speed with which you take in the world around you and the ability to slow it down and see more than you saw before.
Yeah, I wish I could say I always go slowly, especially at the moment. We're rebuilding our house after this fire and doing all the stuff for the book and doing all the conservation work with the NGO. It sometimes feels way too fast. But the great thing about spending time in nature is that absolutely forces one to slow down for at least part of the day and leave all cell phones and everything behind. So I think we are designed to be quite deliberate and not be in a rush. Our species, Homo sapiens, is 300,000 years old, but our Homo family goes back, you know, 3 million years plus. And in all that time, people moved slowly, deliberately, and thought a lot before they did things. It's, as you say, only in the last few seconds, this eye blink, that we've gone into this manic phase of rushing around so fast. It's absolutely unnecessary. But it's hard to stop. The tame world is so seductive that it's hard to stop. But it's so seductive that we actually have to put measures in place. And that's why I do these rituals in the morning of breathing, meditation, exercise, and that, to just slow that whole thing down, slowly cook a meal, slowly have a cup of coffee, contemplate, and then there's, you know, time for work and everything. So I think it's a quite a critical thing, but it's difficult.
The new book by Craig Foster is Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. Thank you for joining me, Craig.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for incredible questions and insights and for reading and understanding the book at such a deep level. Bless you, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.